This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Lukes here at the Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome my guest, normally from central Victoria, but from Adelaide at the moment, Neville Archibald. Welcome, Neville.
Yeah, operating in real time today.
No worries. Pleased to have you. We had the national weekend across this weekend, and it was good fun had by all. It was lovely to speak to people and see them face to face. And so we did. We actually had a quite a good weekend, which has continued on this past week. People still in Adelaide before they head home. So that in itself was the good. I'm pleased to have been part of it, and of course the Neville was part of it too, as was the other members of the League of Rights. So pleased to have them, and pleased to be party to it. So your thoughts on the weekend, Neville, please.
Yeah, very, very enjoyable. Three papers presented on the will to freedom, the will to power, which took several different turns, actually, which was quite interesting because we all had a different look at it. It's a bit like a group of writers getting together and looking at a picture and then going away and writing a story, and each comes back with something totally different. But the discussions afterwards, of course, are always the meat and potatoes, and they were brilliant. Yeah, it's around the table for tea. Continuing on to this point, we're still talking and enjoying it. It's a super long weekend, so yeah, that's good. Yep. Yeah, we sort of addressed. Yeah, I was going to say. We addressed almost three different parts, I suppose, of the theme. One was more spiritual, I guess. One was philosophical, and the other was practical, I suppose. Yeah, it's amazing what you can achieve when you get together and you start talking about things, and it's something that I'd suggest anybody out there who's looking to improve their knowledge or awareness of what's going on in the world to actually get together in little groups, if it's your freedom group, and pick a topic and do a little bit of research on it and present it to your little group. It only has to be 2 minutes, but it'll bring forth discussion, and you'll start to question reasons behind things. And as a group, you'll grow and you'll be much more capable of doing what you want to achieve. So, yeah, that's what I find from this sort of thing. I miss not being able to do it more than once a year. In that regard, because we're so far apart, but when we do, we make the most of it. Thanks, Arnie.
Yeah, no, that's the very point, that you're actually working together, and you do have diverse points of view, and spiritual, practical, and theoretical or philosophical, all in one one instance, if like one instance of the different cases. That to me is an important part of the discussions had by all. To me, the weekend continues on, reverberates actually, in the sense that the individuals thinking collectively, putting their points of view across, and of course those points of view working out to a whole. Because the point is that you won't see the whole picture unless you've got diverse points of view. You'll only see a part of it, and that to me is an important phenomena, that the individuals coming together will promote a all-rounded view, a more wholesome view of the situation, and that to me is the important part. So we've got two meetings coming up. One is the American Monetary Institute and the Pilgrims, of course, next year, with the May next year. That to me is an important part of the social credit, the Douglas social credit perspective, that it's just not the one point of view, one instance, but rather the diverse, and it is really diverse because it's not just the monetary, although monetary is important, But it also takes into account the different perspectives on the phenomena. Now, the thing I guess you look at today is the artificial intelligence. It's called artificial intelligence, but really it's nothing of the sort, but it is a phenomenon that's occurring. And of course, the mundane routine tasks performed by people are actually being performed by machines. And this creates a leisured class. And to me, the leisured class don't actually have a say in what's going on. They don't actually have a say in a sense of, well, okay, that's fine. You've made us the leisured class. But how are we to get paid? How are we to actually find fulfillment in our vocation of not being required to work? This to me is the important point that the modern age, and of course the likes of Doug saw this 100 years ago, and it's not being an adequate airplay. And this to me is the undoing in a sense that we've got all of this potential. All this potential of the potential artificial intelligence, of the potential of robotics to take over the mundane tasks that people do, and it's not being taken into account. It's certainly not being considered. And the point, I guess, of this exercise is that it must be considered, because you've got a world that can't be fully gainfully employed. You've got a world that actually can't continue to function with the point of being productive, in a sense. Yeah, being productive. They can't function in there because there's no work for them. And so what are they going to do? And this to me is where Douglas social credit comes into it, because they have pre-thought through the consequences of the national dividend. They haven't thought through the consequences of the basic income. They haven't thought it through. They haven't actually taken into account that, oh, we'll tax a little bit off these people and we'll redistribute it in the form of a basic income. And that's at all. That's not the phenomena that we're looking at, because the payment is based on tax, and that is not thought through, because of course progressive taxation is a consequence of not only Marxism, which it is a consequence of Marxism, but it's a question of, well, yes, we can tax the people, but they can't afford to pay, and so the basic income in a sense cannot be afforded. And so this is an undoing of the phenomena of this age. It's an undoing of it. So while I can argue all I like about the basic income as being a necessary tool, the point being that people can only afford so much taxation and they can't afford to pay. And this to me is the phenomena of the basic income movement, that it hasn't been thought through. It hasn't been adequately thought through, whereas the national dividend has been thought through, and it's a release of new credit. It's a release, and it goes out into the community, and even those that are working, because you can see the consequence of those that are working are actually being forced to work longer and longer hours, and yet the consequence is that they don't get to take home any more money. They don't get to take home any more privileges, and those that aren't working, of course, are essentially put on the scrap heap. And so this is a dualism, if you like, a disparity between the benefits of the social credit movement and the benefits of the basic income movement. And they won't be the same. They won't be anywhere near the same. Anyway, your thoughts, please, Neville Archibald.
Yeah, I mean, you say Douglas was 100 years ago. That he thought about it and saw it. But I'd sort of say the canary in the coal mine probably goes back to 1779 or 1778, I think it was, which is something that's in our lexicon at the moment. When you think of the word Luddite, someone who was anti-technology and wants to go back to basics, development of that, of course, is attributed to Ned Ludd, the weaver, who was replaced by an automated loom, and he broke up the looms. And there was a group that sort of group of followers that decided to do much the same thing. I don't know how factual all of the stuff you read on the internet is, but that's where the saying comes from. That's where the genesis of the word Luddite. And he can see that, you know, he's being put out of work. Now, he can still do weaving and still sell his product, but at a greatly reduced price, because the automated loom could increase the output so much that it devalued his work. So, you know, him and his fellow workers at the time, when we were going from an agrarian economy into a more machine-operated economy, were finding that the work that they were doing was becoming devalued, and their incomes were being usurped. The machines were doing it, so there was no one being paid. And it wasn't just the weavers, it was the people mowing the hay or threshing the grain or even grinding it. As things went through, there was a whole class, a whole series of people who once relied upon that basic manual labor, some quite specialized, that was being automated, that would no longer have the money to feed their families or raise families. So in a way, they were the canary in the coal mine. They were the ones that were saying, hey, there's something going on here. Now, we had a new world to expand into. So we expanded. All these people who became destitute or found that they could no longer find things, there was pressure to move them somewhere else. So they immigrated. No work here. We'll immigrate. And they went to Canada and Australia, the US. They had somewhere to expand into. And while we were expanding, that was all good, well and good, because people found new ways. And that's, we're a pretty bloody resourceful lot. We, as a society, we can turn our hands to a lot of things, and we can create more employment when new things come around. Someone has to build the machines, which is only a small part of the labor force that's being displaced. You have to retrain. There's always a lot of people that end up less than gainfully employed. And that's not reflected. Now, because once they've been displaced, the money that they would have used from their labor to buy the bread that was baked by the baker who, you know, had the miller and everybody involved in the process all the way down the chain was paid, and then they went and bought their bread. But once those people are no longer gainfully employed and don't have the money, the baker can still bake just as much or probably even more, but the wages aren't there to buy it. So in that small community, the baker then has to go outside of his area and start selling it somewhere else. Or he's got to sell his produce at a greatly reduced price just to sell it. So you have the problem of overproduction, which isn't really overproduction in that case, because if the people can't buy it, it means it's under consumption. And there's a really big difference between those two concepts. And I think that's something that people should be thinking about when we talk about it. All these economic terms that you hear from the finance black magic of finance today, their jargon and everything, you can look at them till the cows come home, and seriously, they don't make any sense, even when you get them to explain them to you. You know what, we had stagflation and shrinkflation and so many different things. And that goes back, you know, to the shrinking economy or the shrinking workforce or, you know, or the stagnating of something else, but it's really just devaluing the dollar. And that devaluation comes about because things are produced that can't be consumed. So yeah, Ned and his Luddites saw it, but they couldn't describe it, and I don't think anyone wanted to know about it. So they just did what they could do, which was expand into other areas. They exported people and exported jobs. And we've seen the same thing since Douglas explained what it was all about and went to the palace in charge, and they sort of didn't want to know about it. I think they already knew about it, but that's an entirely other story. So we've gone on to that point, and we've kept producing, and we've got more and more robots, more machines doing the work of the people who would normally do it, which is great, because that's what labor saving is all about. It's to create a class where you've got more leisure time. But the money associated with that loss of time in the workplace doesn't appear in your pocket. Not automatically. You don't get it. No one else seems to get it. If it is got, it's paid back, paying back the debt from the person who borrowed the money to build the machine in the first place. And when debt's cancelled, it's no longer available to buy anything. So, the machine's earning money, but can't spend it. Who spends the machine's money? It's crazy. So that's why we find that, you know, we've got people on the unemployment heap. And then all of a sudden, the government says, well, we'll pay you an unemployment dividend and we'll keep you alive. You'll be fine. Where do they get their money from? They tax the workers again. And it's not just heavy tax that's suddenly, you know, going to reduce your income. It reduces the spending power and your ability to buy the goods that are being produced. So this, we're still producing stuff, but all of a sudden we've got even less to produce, because what happens? It goes into the pockets of somebody else. They've then got it to spend, I suppose. But it's a vicious circle. And because a lot of the government's overdrafts are created as debts too, you've then got to service the debt. You've then got to pay the debt back. The debt being created as new money gets cancelled. And it takes money out of the economy. So we can never catch up to the amount being produced with what's in our pockets. It's just impossible. So then you see the rise of things like built-in obsolescence, because, well, it's lasting too long, or we need to produce more. Let's make them break down quicker. And that has a huge impact again. It's snowball effect. You know, then you get, oh, well, there's pollution and, you know, there's all this sort of thing and we've got to deal with that. And then the earth's in trouble because, you know, we've got this pollution and we've got to find ways to fix it. And of course, climate tax and carbon credits is the next best thing to do that. Let's just put a carbon tax on everybody. That'll magically fix the problem. But of course, we know it won't, because they're still producing stuff they can't get rid of. It's interesting. When you said Douglas was, 100 years since he saw the problem, well, yeah, he saw it back in 1779. He couldn't articulate it. And we found another way around it. And I think since Douglas, they've found other ways around it again too. At some point, when we've totally settled the earth, which we have, it's going to bite us on the bum. Thanks, honey.
Yeah. And to me, that's the point, that the Luddites were right, in the sense that the machines are doing the work of men, and so the man is redundant. And the point is, there's nothing put in place. There's no reserved powers that are put in place in order to bring these things about, in order to bring the necessary spending power to bring it about. And of course, Douglas was in his genius, saw the same thing, or that the automatic age was upon us, the electronic age was upon us. How do we do it? Well, we do it with a national dividend, so that it's actually addressed. The point of order, if you like, isn't just the chronic shortage of spending power, although that is part of it. It is actually that the spending power that you do get paid is created in the form of debt-free credit. You say debt-free. What is debt-free credit? It means that if the government wants to issue a bond in order to spend on the bond, in order to spend the effects of the bond, if you like, on the government, if they want to send that power into being, then it means that they have to do it in a fashion that doesn't create debt. Now, what was the word I used the other day? It was really good. Renting of money. The renting of money, in the sense that the government wants to spend a bond, it needs to have the bond financed for sure. But the question then comes to, is, should it be financed debt-free? And the answer is, this is the type of thinking that you've got to actually put into place. The type of mental gymnastics that requires the government to spend debt-free credit on submarines, on a new bridge, on a roadways, whatever it is, whatever these projects are. But of course, the government is indebted to central banks. And then you think, well, hang on a sec. Why is it that central banks are actually issuing this credit? Why doesn't the government issue this credit in the first place? And that's a very, very good question, because they should. They should actually issue the credit debt free. And that to me is the point that Douglas never shorted, never tired of reinforcing. The government's issued the debt, the credit. They issued the credit debt free. And to me, this is the point we've got to consider. We've got to actually go back to the very beginnings of, well, of course, they should have done it in the machine age. They didn't. They should have done it in the advanced control age, and they didn't. They should have done it in the artificial intelligence age, and they didn't. And this is the point. This is the budgie, the canary in the coal mine. There is your analogy, and it's exactly right. They should have done it. They haven't done it. And now we've got to the stage where we've handed over central power of credit creation to banks, central power, central authority to these centralized banks. They're the only ones that can create the credit. And so the government issues currency, but only on a rented basis, only on a basis that it pays interest on the rented money. And of course, there's no way we can pay it all back, and we can't pay it back because the interest component is short, and so is the wages of the machine. It's all short. And this to me is, this is where we've got to come to grips with. This is where we've got to rethink it through. And the fact is that the economists are not helping us at all. They're not doing anything that's actually showing that we can actually issue this debt free. We can issue this with credit, not debt. We can issue this as new credit and not new debt that's beholden to government and taxes, because it's got to a point where it's feeding on itself. And of course, the governments can't pay back the debt to central banks because they insist that it's an interest component is paid on it. And to me, the bank's day is finished. The bank's day is over, and it's got to get back to modern. It's got to get back to stable modern banking practices, and not the if you like, the usury of the past, because they're utilizing the interest component in order to indebt government to the point where it can't pay back the debt. And this, the interest component itself, is a phenomena that needs to be looked at, that the progressive interest on it makes it to the point where government can't pay back the debt. Anyway, your thoughts, please, Neville Archibald.
That's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing people trying to get away to do this. It's a bit like Ludd. He didn't know how to express himself. And we're seeing people today trying to express themselves in the same way because they're going to crypto or Bitcoin or one of these other new financial representations of how we trade. And the big trap there is, of course, they're searching for that answer. They're searching for a way to get around this problem that the banks have created. But the big trap there, of course, is what system are they going to use? Whether that system is doing exactly the same thing as the banks. And if the banks get a hold of it, or if the same people controlling the banks get a hold of Bitcoin or crypto, if they're not already involved in it. I haven't gone down that path to look at that. I do know that that's the essential spiritual act of people wanting to leave the current system because it's not working, and they're looking for other options. But if those people who are currently controlling the system get hold of Bitcoin or crypto, if they're not already, as I said, involved in it, then we will see exactly the same thing happen with that. It's like the Chinese social credit score and the Chinese basic income. Again, if it's not issued in the right way, then it will be a controlling feature. It will be a pair of handcuffs. It will be a chain to tie you down. You will be issued with just enough to survive, and they will use it to manipulate society like they are currently doing with money. The question came up, of course, on the weekend. We talked between spiritual and practical, and we bang on a lot about money. I know we do as social creditors, and that's one of the things that often people say, "Oh, you're all about money." We're actually not, or I know I'm not. But the problem is that's where the rubber meets the road. Our money system is what makes us what helps us to interact, and we can't do without it. Now, are we going to get out of this problem through a spiritual reformation, or are we going to do it in a practical way? Well, they both work together. You can't isolate the two. It is a spiritual component. We have to learn to be better people. We have to learn to follow in Christ's footsteps. And I don't apologize for being Christian. I don't apologize for that comment, because if we look at the teachings of Christ, it's how we keep the social cohesion of a country together. And we've seen Mr. Albanese and his mates there going, banging on about, oh, all these nasty marchers who don't want any more immigration. They're ruining our social cohesion. That's important. We have to have social cohesion. Well, Mr. Albanese, this is how you get social cohesion. You address the banking problem and you stop the problems from coming back by instituting a correct procedure. So if they're true to their word and they want to see social cohesion, they should be listening. So as I was saying, spiritual or physical, the physical point is the fact that the money is what we have to use. And if we find ourselves running to keep up, try more, earn more and more consumer power to buy the excess goods, the production, which we can never do, then we will be forever running. We won't have our leisure. We will just keep trying to keep up. And then we'll be taking shortcuts because we can't keep up. And those shortcuts then lead us into doing things that we wouldn't normally do. You've all heard the saying, oh, it's only business. You know, don't take it, don't be offended by it. I've ruined your business and taken it off you. But it was only business, nothing to do with your livelihood or the moral obligation that you really had to see that the person who is conducting his business has got somewhere else to go, or, you know, you do it in an amicable way. He's happy to hand over the reins of his business. But if you're doing a big takeover, or if you're trying to buy out your neighbour and he doesn't want to be bought out, but you take advantage of his poor season instead of helping him, then that is the death of the spiritual side of social cohesion, because you're finding shortcuts and you're justifying it. And that's how this lack of money has turned our society into a dog-eat-dog, cat-eat-cat world where we're all competing against each other so hard that we no longer take note of what is morally right. I've left a couple of jobs because I could no longer stomach the moral corruption that I saw around me. Now, I'm a pretty robust sort of a character. I'm happy to do some things, but when it comes to doing things that I feel is not within my moral sphere, I don't do it. That's non-negotiable. And if my boss at any of those particular things happened to have said that at that time, oh, you should be sorry, you'll find someone else to do it, I will not do that. Usually made gainfully employed because of it. They figured my limitations and they were happy to work around them because, yeah, you know, that's just, if you do it, you can still get away with it. Trust me, if you're a good worker and you keep your moral principles, you will be recognized, and generally you will not end up on the unemployment heap. I can vouch for that. But that's where everybody has to do it. When it came down to the COVID jab, so many of my companions at work, oh, I don't want to get it. I don't want to get it, but I have to travel. Because I've got to go and see Granny in the nursing home, or that they always found a justification for stepping on the moral principles that they did not want to cross. And money does that. Money does that. And it's the corruption of the money system that is causing the spiritual decline. That spiritual decline has to come back. Spiritual decline has to be brought back into place, because if we all just said we saw something was wrong and we said no, or we saw someone doing something wrong and we asked for it to be reversed, it would be reversed, because there'd be enough of us to actually stand up and put that pressure on, and it would be just organic. It would just grow. So don't immediately equate your moral principles with church or with a particular breed of church. It's our society's cohesion that our moral principles are built upon, or it's society's cohesion relies upon them. It's our trust. That's our what's the word, Annie? it's the glue that keeps us together. There's a word I can't think of at the moment, but that's what it is.
Great. No worries. Thank you for that. That's right. It's the substance that holds it together, and that to me is the point. That we've got our communities, we've got our societies. We're watching it fall apart. We're watching the other things take our interest, and yet the community, the society, the conducing of the fabric of what it is to be an Australian, what it is to be an American or a British or whatever, what it is, and we're seeing that just being undone. And that to me is the valid point. We're finding immoral answers, and they are immoral, in almost every sphere of life. And that's, to me, this is the concentration, this is the area that we've got to concentrate on, because we've got to do better. And we do have to do better. What would you call it? The getting on is one thing, the getting on of society is one thing, but it's got to actually work within the way we do things, and the way we morally, the way we ethically, the way we work around these things. Because are we honestly, is the point of the association so weak, so susceptible, if you like, to corruption, that we forget about the moral, when in actual fact it's the very thing that's holding it together? And this to me is the point. We've been through two world wars, we've been through the even the South African war, the Boer war, we've been through that, and we never really asked the question, and yet we need to actually ask this question of what are the area for work, what was it the soldiers fought for, what was it that they fought for? Because it was an idea, but it was an ideal, and the ideal of course is that you only do unto him what you'd have him do unto you. That to me is the ideal, and we've got to concentrate on it, that the that it's to me this area that must be worked through. To me this is the obvious point. The weekend we saw the different points of view, we saw that they were complementary to each other, not antagonistic. And to me, that's the point, that that we've got to actually look and look harder and think further, that to find the complementary, to find the point that actually blesses the society more than it actually just imposes its will arbitrarily. Why should we look for just an arbitrary answer when it's when there's actually a blessing? And that to me is the important part, that the is it considered the lilies of the field and all their righteousness brought about by pursuing a true and honest goal? And that to me is where we've got to do it. We've got to consider it. Your thoughts, please, Neville.
In talking there, we're talking about when we consider it, and we're talking about the people who went to war and the reasons they went to war. It wasn't ideal. Every Remembrance Day, every Anzac Day, we should be thinking about that too. Mm-hmm. It was the moral fibre of the people who went, and it was to maintain social cohesion. It was for the best at that time. That's what they thought. This is for the best of our country, and we don't want to see our ideals corrupted. So that's a very good time every year. Twice a year we can do it. We can think about more than just the people who died, because it's far more than that. It is about what they died for, the reason for it. Often that's touched on in the sermons or the speeches that are given during Anzac Day or Remembrance Day. But to those out there giving those speeches, there's your opportunity to actually make a point to bring about more social cohesion by talking about the reasons, the moral reasons why they stood up for what they believed, and that we should emulate them. The will to power, the will to freedom being the beginning of the speech. So we spoke about, we looked at those things, and we thought that the will to power was, people. And my initial look at that, the will to power is those people who are greedy and egotistical and want to get in there and grab that power for themselves. And the other side, the will to freedom, was people who didn't want that, basically, that they're two comparable things. But in reality, you know, ponder on it a bit longer, it's not. I mean, our freedom, remaining our freedom, depends on what, on the power we can wield. So if we can wield the power to get ourselves free, that's the wielding of power, but it's for the intention that we're wielding it. Over history, we've seen that the strongest survive, you know, the survival of the fittest is because they have the drive to get that power and wrestle it from everybody else, and use it to their own purposes. And when you think about it, that's a indication of our society's level of health, I suppose, who's wielding that power. And in this case, we've got people who are greedy and egotistical, and all the things that the people who want freedom aren't, who are, they have the drive, they have the guts in them to get in there and grab that power for themselves. And because we're Christians, or people who believe in basic Christian love, and we don't want to do any harm to anyone else, we want to just get on with our neighbors and give everybody a fair go, we don't want to wrest that power. We don't want to be a part of that power. We don't want to be seen as chasing power. And I think that's our letdown. That's our strongest weakness, if you can have a strongest weakness, because that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Yeah, that's our biggest weakness, is the fact that, you know, we don't justify us going for power as being the right thing to do. But the reality is, if we don't wield that power, somebody else will. And it's not a power necessarily. Or we have to put up the fences. We have to put up the barriers to say that we're not going to allow this. And that's why we created the Constitution. That's why we've created the legal system over, you know, 1,500 years, whatever it is, with the rise of the system that we're working under. We're innocent until proven guilty, habeas corpus, all of the comments you might make, or anything that suddenly springs to mind when you're talking about the old legal system, when you watch a Perry Mason movie or whatever it is, all those things come from the Christian background of loving thy neighbor and doing what's right. And that's the moral side of the story that I'm sort of talking about. But the wielding of that power, if we're only going to leave it to those people who are greedy and egotistical and we're not going to stop them, then we're as much at fault for the situation we're in as they are. Thanks, Arnie.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Neville. That the point of the exercise, today's exercise, is the working, the will to power against the will to freedom, these two competing forces. The thing is that you do need the will to power, but not at the expense of pursuing or not pursuing freedom, not pursuing freedom, but rather that you still need to pursue freedom. But power has got its source, power has got its origin, yes, but not to the degree that it has got an influence over and above the will to freedom. And this to me is an important point. We're looking at, say, in Australia, the Commonwealth government pursuing power, the Commonwealth government through the states pursuing power. The will to power is overriding the local communities, it's overriding the common people, it's overriding the states at times in order to implement policy. And we've got to actually bring it back. We've got to bring the Commonwealth back. We've got to bring the states back, where the people have actually got a say in the role of the Constitution, in the role of documents, in the role of the courts. We've got to bring that back. And to me, this is the obvious area for work. We can try all we like to ignore it, but at the expense of what? And to me, this is the point of the whole exercise: is why are we ignoring it when, in actual fact, we should be pursuing it? And yeah, the likes of it, the truth of it, of the unfolding of it. To me is something that we have to take on ourselves. I guess the point, what is the point? The will to power, the will to freedom, is that the will to freedom must be pursued just as vigorously as the will to power. But it is that the will of the individual. Should you be allowed to do it? Should you not be allowed to do it? I think we've got to actually look at this question. We've got to seriously look at it, because yes, we've got this age of Luddites, and we've got this age of artificial intelligence that is circumventing all of these efforts for the individual to pursue, but we've got to push back. We've got to pursue these other things, that the will to freedom is far more important, that it cannot be ignored, and that the survival of the fittest is a saying. Is it a true and legitimate saying? Is it a moral saying? And I don't believe it is, because there's no moral answer in it. Only do unto him what you'd have him do unto you. So that's not survival of the fittest. Only do unto him what you'd have him do unto you. So it's a moral code right there, right in that statement. And the moral code is what is lacking. Survival of the fittest. Are we just to let the run roughshod over the individual? Or are we to actually pull them back and say, no, that's not the right answer. The right answer is that you only do unto him what you'd have him do unto you. And of course, this pursuit of power, in the sense that the survival of the fittest is going to get the nod. Well, why should it get the nod when in actual fact there's no moral anchor? And that's to me, this is the very point of what we're talking about, of what we saw across the weekend, was the moral anchor with the will to power is imbalanced. And to me, that's so obvious that the balance is balancing between the two isn't there, and we've got to bring it back. Albanese, he's only one. He is only one, and that's the point, that he is only one. And there's a vast majority of people who don't agree with him, but they don't realise that they must say something. They don't realise that they can't sit on their hands any longer. They must say something and bring this back into order. Your thoughts, please. Summary comments, Neville.
Summary comments. Survival of the fittest. Oh, I agree with survival of the fittest, aren't you? It suits the people who are in power. Guess this film. I am not an animal.
I'm not Notre Dame.
The elephant man.
Yeah.
The elephant man. Hunchback, yeah. No, the elephant man, different. But I think the hunchback also said that too, actually. Yeah, are we animals? That's a serious question. Are we animals? Are we among the survival of the fittest? I don't put myself there. I'm a human being. I have a higher calling. I have a spiritual side. I'm not an animal. I will not, go out and hunt down the weakest and eat them. I'm not. That's not my view on life. Certainly, but I think it is the view of many of the people who are seeking power. Mm. They're willing to do anything. They're willing to do anything, and they justify it somehow, as though the weakest in our society are not men, they are animals. And I think that's one of the humanist traits, where we are just another animal, we can do this, we can do that. And it's a bit of a corruption. So again, we see that, it's a bit of a joke aside. If we are who we are, then what is our aim? What is our purpose? And I think that's a question that needs to be asked. Earlier on, you said about the wielding of power, and some people have the drive. And I was thinking of a diesel engine. A diesel engine doesn't have a spark to ignite it. You compress the fuel to such a point that it gets hot and it explodes. I don't know that that's a good analogy for our society, but we're being depressed, we're being compressed, we're being pushed at all sides. And at some point, one would think that, like a diesel engine, we would have to explode. I don't want to see that. I think we need to do it long before the detonation point. If it's a petrol engine and there's a spark, it'll happen a bit earlier. But I don't want to see it get to that point, because then you have all that energy released, and it usually goes the way of the mob. And a mob is unruly, and a mob can be manipulated by clever people. The French Revolution, where they cut off the heads of anybody who they thought was possibly a royalist or in fault in some way. And they all cheered and they all clapped and they all stood around and they were happy and they're having picnics. I don't want to see that. That's not who we are. That's not who we should be at this point in our evolution, if you call it an evolution. It's a spiritual journey for the whole of society, and that's where we are at this point. We've got to look at, do we want to go backwards? Because that's what's going to happen if we get to that compression point and there is an explosion. So the time is now to do something. The time is now to release that pressure by getting out there and talking to people and getting them to assert their power. And they have it. And if they can do it in little things, they'll get a taste for it and they'll get an idea that, okay, to keep this sort of life that I want, I do have to exercise power. It's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah,
more power to the people.
more power to the people. That's exactly
right. The reasonable people.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Exactly right. And the thing is that they won't, without knowing it, they won't be involved, and they'll just sit on their hands. Whereas if they are involved and they are knowing it and they are active in their community, then of course this whole thing can be turned around. It will. That's right. So yes, now is the time. Now is the inclination that we've got to actually turn this critical point in history back on itself. Can the Australian people, the English, the Americans, whatever, can they do something about it? Yes, they can. The question is, will they do it? Of course they will, but they must do it now. Yeah. Thank you, Neville. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Luke signing off from the Crossroads. Cheers then.
Cheers.
This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.